they make that tango grata ta ta.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Hour of Influence. You're listening to WJRH 104.9 FM, Lafayette College, Radio Easton, Pennsylvania. So this is the first episode of our new show. We have five hosts. We have myself, Hype Henry. We have...
I'm Max. I'm out in the field.
Connor.
And then, of course, we have our other main host, Kyle, the Kyle. Who is not here this week due to a religious holiday. And of course, the D1 athlete, Brendan, who's off playing golf. So to start off this show, this is a kind of non-traditional week based on what we're doing. We're a talk show. We also have a lot of skits and music. But since we're missing two of our guests, we figured we'd air our first long-form interview. So this interview is with the Attorney General of New Jersey, Chris Perino, and we get through a lot of things, including the first time he's ever talked about Bridgegate to an interviewer, in addition to talking about the opioid epidemic, child pornography, and college advice. So I'm going to pass it over to Connor to kind of talk about other skits that we'll have when we come back.
Yeah, right, guys. So like the Hype Henry was saying over there, you know, this is kind of an atypical week. Next week we also have off from school, so in the week after that you're gonna be seeing a bunch of skits going on. We're gonna have the Love Doctor with Brendan. We're gonna have the In the Field with Max, getting some great commentary on the school, and we're even gonna have a bunch more skits and things coming your way. But I hope you guys all tune in 1 o'clock as usual. Some other things you guys can look forward to: we're going to have some crazy senior week parties. We're going to have members calling in and telling us about all their experiences here at college on Campus Hill. And so looking forward to it, guys. Hope you tune in every Saturday, 1 p.m.
Definitely, definitely. So, Max, you want to talk a little bit about your Out in the Field?
Yeah, sure, Henry. So my segment every week is called Out in the Field with Max, and I go around campus every week just asking people like a bunch of random questions, seeing what they respond to, all that stuff. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
So let's start out with the interview. Since this is a non-traditional week, we're going to air this in long form. Usually we'd do it in a little bit of pieces, and we'd come back with different skits. But let's just hear a little song, and then when we come back, we'll start the interview. So the song we're going to play first is a classic song that might remind you of running up the rocky steps. So, you know, I think it'll pump us up a bit for the interview. And it should be a great vibe. So I'll see you guys in about 3 minutes. So yeah, now we're going to actually air the interview. Just let us get it up. So yeah, guys, just sit back and enjoy.
You're here in a special segment to interview the Attorney General of New Jersey, Chris Perino. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No problem. It's our pleasure. Yes. So as college kids, which we are now, we know you went to our arch rival, Lehigh University. How can you talk about how you think college has shaped you and the importance of going to college for kids today?
So, you know, Max... as you know, is here with you. I went to Lehigh. I tried to convince him to go to Lehigh, and he wouldn't listen to me, and he decided to come to Lafayette. And I have to say that, you know, for the last 3 weeks, we've been really, really impressed. In terms of my own experience at Lehigh, you know, it was great. Learned a lot, very, very challenging academically, but I didn't really figure out what I wanted to do until, you know, later on, way on into my Lehigh years, and really only after I got into law school.
Definitely. And in some background information, we read that you weren't even considering law until your girlfriend at the time suggested you take the LSAT. Well, what other careers were you looking at?
Yeah, that's also true. I was headed, I thought, to medical school, and then I ran into, like, organic chemistry and then physics. And my girlfriend at the time at Lehigh said, "Why are you torturing yourself? Why don't you play to your strengths? You're a good writer." And she said, "Why don't you just take the LSAT and see what happens?" And so that's what I did. Ended up going to law school. And after I was nominated as Attorney General, she reached out and said, "You're welcome."
That's it's a very interesting point. So we obviously you have a high stress job. A lot of these liberal arts colleges, such as Lafayette and even Lehigh, to an extent, it's very academically rigorous, really kind of close knit communities. So a lot of kids in general, law school, liberal arts schools, college in general, kind of deal with this kind of adjustment stress on a daily basis. So as someone that has like one of the biggest public sector stress filled jobs. How would you kind of advise students to kind of deal with that stress?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the best advice that I can give to students who are getting started is to focus on the week that's in front of you. You know, on Monday, don't think about 4 months from now. Think about getting to Friday, and take it in baby steps. Try and get sleep, you know, do what I didn't do, which is to go to class every single time, and really try not to miss class. And if you do those things and you keep up with your reading, I think the stress level, the academic stress level, is much less. You know, the social piece of it is what it is. It's a big adjustment. You know, I know for my own part, when I went to Lehigh, I had never spent any time away from home. You know, for many kids starting college, it's still the same. And you know, same story there. Take it in baby steps. And my advice to my kids is, if you have one good friend, you know, you'll be just fine.
Definitely. So as we kind of progress in this interview, obviously after you went to Lehigh, you went to Seton Hall Law School, and you kind of talk about in some of your quotes about like the competition there, especially in law school. So for like the gov law majors, really anyone thinking about going to a type of graduate school, can you talk about the type of competition that you faced and maybe how your personality made that challenging as a youth?
Sure. So one of the things that I realized somewhere along the way in law school, and then after I graduated law school, was that I was alongside and to some degree in competition with some pretty aggressive personalities. You know, I say people with really sharp elbows, folks who are willing to, you know, sort of step on your head to get to the next level, or elbow you out of the way to get ahead. And I worried as a young lawyer about whether, you know, without those sharp elbows, whether I would advance. And what I came to learn over a long period of time, and that's why I try and tell younger people about this, because it took me probably 15 years of studying law and then being a lawyer to realize, if you don't have sharp elbows, you know, don't worry about it. The bosses and, you know, advancement is really based on achievement and trust. People with sharp elbows who do things that are underhanded, I find over time fall back. And the individuals who are earnest, try and do the right thing, and protect others as opposed to trying to step on others, really, you know, in the long run, end up advancing to much greater heights and overall more quickly.
Definitely, that's a very interesting perspective. So, as someone on a liberal arts campus, we see a lot of kind of social justice and, to an extent, the PC culture. A very big kind of protesting segment of the population. How do you kind of deal with the Black Lives Matter and PC culture area, especially in such a kind of like highly controversial area, like a college campus or like all around New Jersey?
Sure. So it's a really good question, Henry. And, you know, what I say about this is I'm not an elected attorney general. Unlike most attorneys general across the country, I'm appointed, nominated, and then confirmed, ultimately, by the legislature. So I don't have to worry about getting people to vote for me. And I don't have to worry about taking positions that are going to be popular. So what we try and do in light of that is just pick the path that's the right one. And I don't, you know, it would be easier for me to say that, you know, all of the community activists who believe that most police officers, you know, start out wanting to hurt people, in some respects, be easier for me to say that they're right in New Jersey. The truth is they're not right. And the vast, vast majority of law enforcement in New Jersey is well-intentioned and highly skilled and really doing heroes work day in and day out. Every once in a while, unfortunately, someone does have bad intentions or makes a mistake. When that happens, they're dealt with appropriately. And I don't, so to answer your question, I don't get hung up on what is popular, what is necessarily politically correct. We just try and make good decisions and make correct decisions regardless of whether they're politically correct or popular.
Okay, so that will transition us into this next question. How was being Attorney General, how has it changed your opinion of the police?
That's another really good question. I will tell you that as a civilian, really didn't think that much or that often about law enforcement. It's just not... You know, I was fortunate enough to have an upbringing where my interactions with law enforcement were few and far between and mostly positive. But it's not a subject I spent a lot of time thinking about. Once I got into this job and, you know, as a chief law enforcement officer of a state, you start thinking about these issues a lot. And one of the things that I've really come to appreciate is the heroism. I mean, we have police officers in New Jersey and across the country that die in the line of duty with, you know, unfortunate regularity. And these individuals wake up every morning knowing that, you know, that day may be their last. And that's a heavy cross to bear. So I have an increased respect for law enforcement, having taken this job, and more appreciation for the work that they do.
Now, you were talking a lot about violence of police and violence against police. Can you talk about a little what your office is trying to do about violence reduction and the coverage that that gets?
Yeah, sure. So, look, when I took this job, you sit down and you try and decide what you're going to focus on and what your priorities are going to be. at the end of the day, the department that I head is called the Department of Law and Public Safety. And so what I decided was that we needed to focus on matters that were life and death type issues. So, violence reduction is a, if you take out in terms of causes of death in New Jersey, if you pull out diseases, heart disease, cancer, and the rest, you really have at the top of the list of what's killing people, drug addiction, murders and violent crime, and a couple of other categories, including traffic fatalities. And so one of the things I did early on after looking at those statistics was to decide to focus on drug addiction, on violent crime, and on traffic fatalities. And so on the violent crime side, there's a number of things that we did over the course of the last year that I hope when we look at the numbers at the end of this year will show a reduction. We are prosecuting gun cases more aggressively than we ever have. We have new rules under what's called bail reform, which is a subject that we could spend an hour talking about, that allows us to detain gun offenders prior to trial, whereas before, offenders like that, if they had access to money, would be able to bail themselves out and commit further offenses. And a number of other initiatives, including the state's most successful gun buyback, where we took almost 5,000 guns off the street in a weekend. It normally takes police across the state more than a year to take that many guns off the street. So those are a few things we're focused on. I think when it comes to what you'll see in the newspaper, and if you were out researching prior to this interview, most of the things I just said you will not see prominently in the news. And it's just, not something that, at least in our media market, the media is as focused on as perhaps they could be. If crime goes up, the media will be focused on that. Efforts to reduce violence and hopefully our success, my guess is, will not be covered with any great vigor.
Good, great.
So you talk about kind of how these statewide initiatives, but how can you kind of work with local leaders to make this happen? And if local leaders made this difficult, New Jersey has a history of corruption, whether we look at mayors such as Sharp James or even like county officials. So building justice, how do you go about that when it's definitely hard to work with some local leaders?
So, there are examples on both sides of the spectrum. Right now in Newark and in Camden and in Trenton, we have very deep relationships with the police directors, the chiefs of police, and the mayors. And so where there's trust and collaboration, there are all kinds of things that we can do as a state agency to help the locals. Newark Police just put a class of new recruits through our State Police Academy in Seagirt. First time that's happened in I don't know how long. And that's really because I'm talking on a regular basis to local leadership in Newark about law enforcement issues. They had a need to get this class trained, and we filled that need. So that kind of collaboration is what you want and will result over time in reducing violence and hopefully reducing crime overall. On the other end of the spectrum, we have local governments that are run by politicians who are corrupt, and those are people we can't work with, and so we can't collaborate and won't collaborate with them to try and solve issues because we can't trust them. And it's an unfortunate reality that we face in New Jersey. Again, the vast majority of public officials in New Jersey and around the country are well-intentioned and are not taking corrupt payments or doing things out of their own self-interest. But you know, on more than one occasion over the last year and a half, you know, we have had to, unfortunately, indict, you know, public officials on corruption charges.
So much like the case in Paterson, New Jersey, recently, where the mayor had been indicted, what steps and steps do you guys take in order to find these people and bring these charges against them?
Yeah, so a number of things, but the most notable step that we took lately was to announce, along with the guilty plea of a local councilman in Bloomfield a few months ago, a program that would, one, reward people for making tips in corruption cases that result in convictions. If you do make a tip between now and November 15th, just after Election Day, there's a $25,000 reward. In addition, for non-elected officials who engaged in corrupt activity and who were not the masterminds of that activity, we have offered, again, up and through November 15th, leniency to those individuals if they come forward and report the conduct to us voluntarily. In that way, we have increased the number of tips that have come through our tip line, and we're able to make more cases against officials who are not doing the right thing. You know, as it relates to the mayor of Paterson, a warehouse that was being redeveloped for members of his family. He did it in broad daylight, and we indicted him, and he stood up and said that he would be vindicated at trial and that he was innocent. Fast forward from March until, what are we now, in September. And, you know, yesterday he apologized to the residents of Paterson and pled guilty in open court. So, you know, we use individuals like that to create an example to try and discourage other public officials from you know, being corrupted in the way that Mayor Joey Torres was.
So when you think about bringing charges as a prosecutor, you know, you obviously have a really hefty thought process in the sense that the decisions you make, the actions you make, can really affect people's lives, whether it's jail or just public disgrace. So when we're talking about Jose Torres or the local city workers he was colluding with, how do you go about deciding whether you're going to prosecute someone or not to?
So it's a very, very arduous process because for years prior to becoming a prosecutor, I was a defense lawyer. And I understand what it means to be charged by the Office of the Attorney General with a crime as serious as corruption or official misconduct. What it means is, and oftentimes, your career is over, your reputation is destroyed, and as everybody knows, it's not so easy to erase your internet history after you're indicted. And so we undertake a very, very careful process before taking a step like that. And not only, you know, use the Paterson example, not only did the indictment in that case negatively impact then-Mayor Torres, it negatively impacts the public's perception of the system. It negatively impacts the citizens of Paterson if it's not an indictment that turns out to be well-founded. And so when this investigation resulted in evidence that people in my office believed should be charged against Joey Torres, they presented me with a lot of detailed information on paper, which I studied, and they asked for my approval to go forward, and I told them no. And I said, I want you guys to come back in next week. I want a full presentation, you know, count by count. I want to see the evidence myself, and I wanted to verify, even though I trusted deeply the prosecutors who were working on this case, I wanted to be able to say for myself that I believed that this mayor was guilty. And after going through that process, I agreed with the prosecutors that he had engaged in illegal conduct. And so after that process, we returned an indictment. But the power that a prosecutor holds in that respect is awesome. And if it's misused, it's, you know, some of the worst misconduct that can be committed in office. You know, I've heard people say that, and sometimes I say, we're the office of the Attorney General. The criminal side of the office is the Division of Criminal Justice. You know, it's the Division of Criminal Justice, not the Division of Criminal Prosecutors. And so the idea, as I've heard Governor Christie say when he was U.S. Attorney, the idea is to do justice, not just go out and prosecute people. And, you know, we exercise that discretion, I hope, in a fair way. In some cases, even where there is misconduct, we decide based on, you know, lots of different factors, sometimes not to prosecute. So it's a very carefully undertaken responsibility, and one that, you know, I take really, really seriously.
So, again, speaking on those kind of terms, you talked about
kind of... The other thing I'll add about that, Henry, is sometimes the, you know, the indictment is, in some respects, the nail in the coffin for a public official. So even the investigation, even undertaking an investigation that becomes public, is a step that has to be very carefully taken. So I get politicians who approach my office all the time saying, my opponent did something wrong, you should issue a subpoena to him or to her, so that when that subpoena issues, you know, the hope is that that will become public and then the opponent will be able to use it in the electoral process. So even the step of beginning an investigation against a public official is one that we take very, very seriously. Unless I believe there's a real reason to undertake that investigation, we don't do it.
Definitely. So you talked about delegitimizing public office, like with these corrupt officials. Do you think that in general, like the more successful cases you bring, further used to delegitimize public office? And do you think that makes your job harder in the long run? Because if people have less trust of these local mayors that are clearly corrupt, then they might be likely to be less trustworthy of, like, the government, the state government, national government. And how do you think that kind of plays?
Yeah, so look, Paterson is the third largest city in New Jersey. And, you know, their mayor yesterday admitted that he violated the law and used city resources for his own benefit. You know, the choice, unfortunately, Henry, is not a, you know, not one that's hard to make. You know, I could either turn my head and, you know, allow this kind of conduct to continue, or try and make examples, prominent examples, out of individuals who break the law. And so what we've decided to do, and I think what most right-minded prosecutors do, is aggressively prosecute those individuals who have engaged in corrupt behavior. What we don't do is willy-nilly go around issuing subpoenas against public officials and creating stories about investigations, because, you know, an investigation is exactly that. It's an investigation. The trouble is, if the news learns that we are investigating a public official, that'll be reported, and a large number of people will take from that news and infer from that news, maybe inappropriately so, but it's the way the world turns, that the individual is being investigated, did something wrong. And so, you know, we'll prosecute officials who engage in wrongdoing, and we'll prosecute them as aggressively as this office has ever prosecuted anyone. What we won't do is undertake investigations, issue subpoenas, just because we can, because even that step has, you know, serious consequences for the recipient of those subpoenas and the subjects of those investigations.
Okay, we're going to use this time to transition into another topic. A very large problem in the U.S. is child pornography. And what have been strategies in the past with how you deal with this? And how have you almost revamped these just ways to deal with it? How have you improved the process of fixing the problem?
Sure. So, child pornography is a bigger problem than most people understand. The public has been desensitized in a large degree to these kind of cases because people get caught with great frequency. It's actually pretty interesting technological phenomenon. These images and videos of child pornography have what are called hash values. It's kind of like DNA that attaches to these particular videos and images. We have technology now where we can effectively trace that DNA for that particular file or that particular photo into someone's house. And so we know that, a particular video that depicts a child being brutalized in a sexual way is being shared in someone's home through IP address that's reported. Once we learn that, we can then issue a subpoena to find out who the IP address belongs to, and the investigation goes from there. A large percentage of individuals who view that kind of filth, I say the basement crawler type of person who is, looking at this stuff on his computer downstairs, a large number of those individuals actually end up being or are already hands-on offenders. So it's not just that they're looking at this stuff. They are many times often acting out and harming kids themselves. And what we say and what we believe is that every time one of these files is viewed or videos is played, the kid's being re-victimized. And they are the market for this stuff. So if offenders are not sharing and watching child pornography, there'd be no market in wherever that child pornography is being manufactured. And so we've approached these cases in two ways. One is to follow this DNA for the files that contain child pornography effectively into the offenders' basements and prosecute them, knowing that, one, it's illegal to view this stuff and to share it, and two, there's a high likelihood that they're, in addition to looking at child pornography, potentially acting out and getting their hands on kids in their locale. The other thing we do is, for lack of a better term, we troll the internet. We're in chat rooms. We're in, on a number of these apps that, seem to change from day to day. But our state police are up on most of the current technology and actually participate as someone who's engaging in a conversation through these apps, not as a police officer, but as an individual. And we'll catch individuals who victimize kids that way. And we've had a number of cases there, too. So what we've done to help our law enforcement who are prosecuting these cases is to try and equip them with the best technology. We've also trained and acquired what I call a porn dog, which is probably not the right term, but for right now, that's the term we're using. That dog, like a bomb sniffing dog or a drug sniffing dog, is trained to sniff out not pornography, but the glue that's used in computers and on hard drives and on thumb drives, so that if an individual is viewing child pornography through a secret, hard drive that he is hiding in his basement, we send, and now can send, our dog into that basement to find the data, whatever that device is that's storing the data, and give us a chance to acquire it and then do the forensics on it.
Definitely. That sounds like a very promising, type of technology. So
when you're dealing with these kind of high-tech criminals and you obviously have a limited budget, how do you kind of decide what technology and what processes you're going to invest in in order to catch these criminals?
It's all about priorities. It really is all about priorities, because you can chase offenders in every direction and catch none. And so you have to decide where you're going to point the laser. And where I've decided to point the laser is where people's safety is at risk. And so whether it's violent crime reduction, or it's drug abuse, or it's traffic fatalities. I mean, distracted driving is killing more and more people in New Jersey. And so we decided to make an investment there to try and continue to educate the public about how dangerous it is to engage in that kind of behavior. We created a hotline where, or expanded a hotline where people can call in and report, as you're driving down the highway in New Jersey, if you see an individual who is reading email or typing a text, you can call #77 in New Jersey, provide that individual's license plate, and if we can pick them up and issue them a summons, we will. If we can't, we'll send a letter to the owner of the car as a warning. Often cases, the car will be owned by someone other than the driver. So for individuals your age, you may not be the owner of the car. If you're distracted driving, your parents will get the letter. And we hope that parents will take the opportunity to have a conversation about how dangerous it is. So we've got some more work to do on that subject in the next couple of months with respect to trying to educate people who have been cited for that conduct, because we see a lot of repeat offenders. So to answer your question, my focus has been, we're going to place resources where we think we can save the most lives and keep the most people safe.
Great. That's great to hear. Seems like you're doing a lot of, you're investing your time, putting into a lot of great technologies as a way to catch people. We pulled a news article from the other day saying that a Roselle man recently pleaded guilty, and you guys had found that he was in possession of over 350 pornographic videos. And would you say that because of this new technology and new physical equipment that you guys were, that made it a lot easier to find and prosecute this guy?
So the interesting thing about this is that we have more tips than we can run down. This technology allows us to identify ISP addresses, or excuse me, IP addresses, where these files are being downloaded through, and we have more tips than we can run down. So the technology is great. What we try and do is, again, prioritize the cases, and when we believe that someone has access to kids, or is a coach, for example, in a grammar school, those cases are prosecuted first and more quickly.
So when we talk about specifics here, such as Dimas Zuniga, who was the man who was arrested, how do you go about charging people that are accused of heinous things, such as child pornography, versus things like corruption? How's the difference? I'd assume there's less leniency. How do you kind of go about that?
Yeah, so there's really... Unless someone has an obvious mental illness, there's not a lot of room for, at least in our cases, for leniency for individuals who are victimizing kids. When it comes to corruption, we're not going to grant leniency to a public official. But if a public official leverages, a real estate developer and says, I'm not going to give you these approvals unless you pay me a bribe, we might be willing, if that developer came in early and was volunteering the information, we might be willing to be lenient in that context. So, it depends. Every case is different. It depends on the circumstances. But when we invest in a case, we don't invest in the case to then go easy on the defendant. In most cases, it's a scenario where we're going to follow through and very often seek extended periods of jail. Child pornography, my point of view on that is, we invest in each and every case we shouldn't be spending that time unless we're going to have an impact on that individual and make sure that that individual is taken out of the circumstance where he can continue to victimize kids.
Absolutely. These people need to be taken off the streets. So with that, we're going to head to a little music break. And when we come back on WJRH 104.9, we're going to talk about the opioid epidemic with Christopher Perina.
Okay, so we're back live in the studio with myself, Hype Henry, Connor, and the Max. And so what do you guys think of what he said so far? So it's been a few days since we actually had the interview in the studio, and he's definitely brought up some good points. How do you feel about the porn dogs? That's pretty funny, isn't
it's crazy
it?
Stuff. Crazy stuff.
Crazy
yeah.
stuff. Now, yeah.
Technology.
Yeah, so it's kind of amazing when you see the different kind of ways people are coming up to fight crimes, because you know they say the criminals have to be lucky all the time, whereas the attorney general and of course the police only have to be lucky once. So it's really interesting to see kind of their creativity to catch these monsters, and also dealing with corruption. So with that being said, we're gonna play a new track. Give you guys a little break. It's "Rich Off Cocaine" by Rick Ross, the Miami native. So we'll see you guys in a few.
Music in the Maybach, that is. Had to take it deep in the rap, baby. Bounce. Butterscotch, every boss take it to another notch. I'm busy, baby, go and suck another. A hater made me throw away another. Money in the mansion, in another spot. It's in the attic, mama help me put them up. She'll pull them down, tell you quick to hit them up. Load 100 rounds, bring it back, she'll fill it up. Like the time when them haters counterfeit. He count chips, but that trick may have got him flipped. We ain't playing men slain for them dollar bills. Quarter million for the chain, up the collar chill.
Miami nights, I'm living the life.
Cause I'm rich off.
Big
Ike, convertible bird, booby game, day counting.
All right, welcome back. You guys are listening to WJRH 104.9 FM Lafayette College Radio, Easton, Pennsylvania. I am Connor, and this is the Hour of Influence. Now we're going to be getting right back into our interview with Chris Perino, the Attorney General. Hope you guys enjoyed that break. All right, let's get it, Henry.
Okay, yeah, guys, we'll see what you think.
PA. This is the Hour of Influence with Hype Henry and the Kyle. Also, we have our co-host Connor in the studio. Now, Max has joined us as well.
So, as we transition to another topic, we really want to get into the opioid epidemic. So, obviously, last year on the campaign trail, that was a huge issue, not only affecting middle America, but as we know through a lot of Chris Christie's administrative policies, that it's a big deal in New Jersey, too. So, we kind of want to discuss that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. All right. How did we get to the how did it become an epidemic?
So that a lot of people have different opinions about all of the causes that got us to this point. And I'm sure that there are more factors than the ones that I'll list, but the ones that I believe are most significant are really three. First, the pharma companies that made and manufactured these drugs and marketed them as, one might argue, less addictive than they actually were. So you have the drug makers. Second, you have the medical profession that prescribed these substances to patients. Maybe not knowing or maybe not spending enough time to try and learn how addictive they really were. And third, you have the patient community who at some point, perhaps with the help of the pharma industry, some would argue that the pharma industry created this environment where everybody decided that they did not want to feel any pain. That the goal was to reduce pain so that you didn't feel it at all. And there are not a lot of ways to reduce pain completely short of opioid painkillers. Opioid painkillers do pain reduction really, really well. The problem is they're also really, really addictive. And so 25 years ago, you know, you'd be hard pressed really to find a lot of people utilizing opioid painkillers and becoming addicted to opioid painkillers. That's because opioid painkillers really weren't used on a widespread basis outside the hospital. You know, when you were in the hospital, you got morphine. When you got out of the hospital, there were other pain medications, but not anywhere near the numbers of opioid-based pain medications that are available now. So we understand, and it was the most surprising statistic that I learned when I got into this job, is that 8 out of 10 heroin addicts walking the street in New Jersey and across the country became addicted through the use of these painkillers. And so too many pain pills on the street, people taking them, becoming addicted, not knowing they were addictive. Pain pills are expensive. And so when you run out of the pills or a doctor won't prescribe them to you anymore, you start to feel withdrawal symptoms. Those withdrawal symptoms, I'm told, won't kill you, but it feels like you're going to die. And so someone who is suffering withdrawal from opioid painkillers, who can't afford more painkillers, has to turn somewhere. And where 80% of them turn is to heroin. Heroin's cheaper. You can buy it on a street corner. You don't need a prescription. The trouble is, you know, eventually it'll kill you.
What are three courses of action you are taking to stop the epidemic?
Yeah, so, you know, there are a couple of things that we've decided to focus on. Once we understood how we believed, at least, we got to an epidemic in New Jersey, then we set out to figure ways to try and beat the epidemic back. The place that we in the Attorney General's office focus most intently on is prevention. Treatment is extraordinarily important for those who are already addicted, because if you don't get good treatment and you're addicted to opioids, eventually you will die. And so treatment's really important. It's not something that my department is particularly well suited to help out on. There are certain aspects of treatment that we do assist with, but providing beds and making sure that good and smart treatment is available is the job of other people in government. We really do spend a lot of time on prevention, and the focus there is on educating the public to make sure that people who are going to take these opioid painkillers because they're feeling pain understand how addictive they are, so they're not effectively being tricked by the pharma industry or by a doctor. Then the other thing that we spend a lot of time doing is just trying to reduce the number of pills that are available on the street. Because if 8 out of 10 people who become addicted to heroin started with pills, we want to reduce the supply and the availability of pills on the street. So, and not everybody of that 80% was suffering from an ailment. Some people got a prescription because, say, they had back pain, started taking painkillers, became addicted. Some percentage also didn't have an ailment. Instead, we're, you know, at a party somewhere and experimenting with, a drug, started taking it recreationally and became addicted that way. And look, the reason why 8 out of 10 heroin addicts started with these pills is because with heroin, it's a real barrier to entry. You know, if you're at a party here at Lafayette and someone walked up to you with a bag of heroin, a needle, and a lighter, and said, "Let's cook some heroin and shoot it," you would, you know, this crew would, you know, probably faint.
No, I'm afraid of a flu shot.
Right. So you're not going to cook up some heroin and inject it. Now, I hope your response would be the same in the next hypothetical, where someone walks up with a bottle of pills and says, you know, "Why don't you try one?" Or it's, you know, the girl you've been courting for the last 3 weeks walks up with a bottle of pills and says, "I'm going to try one. Why don't you try one with me?" I know that you all would say, "I'm not taking that," and, you know, you need help. But I can tell you that not everybody reacts that way. And the reason is because it comes in a bottle that came from, it was prescribed, looks like, by a doctor. The pills were manufactured by a big company somewhere and given out by a pharmacy. You say, "Well, it's not going to kill me." If you look at a bag of heroin and the needle and the spoon that it's going to get cooked in, you say, "That probably is going to kill me." And so heroin is just not something that, after a few drinks, most people are willing to try. A prescription opioid, people were willing to try. And we try our best to educate folks about how addictive they are so they won't use them recreationally. And then in reducing the number of pills on the street, there are a couple of things we've done. First, we've changed the rules about how doctors can prescribe them. You used to be able to go get a wisdom tooth out and walk out of your oral surgeon's office with a 30-day supply. Can't do that anymore. We changed the rules. Now it's the most you can get for acute pain on an initial visit is 5 pills or 5 days worth of pills. The other thing that we're doing is we're prosecuting the doctors who don't follow the rules. So I call them, you know, drug dealers in white coats. These are individuals who have turned their medical practices into, drug dealerships. And, they get paid kickbacks to prescribe opioid painkillers. Oftentimes it's a ring. Doctor provides the pills to individuals who then distribute them to individuals who want to buy them on the street. We've prosecuted civilly and criminally more doctors in the last 18 months than has ever been prosecuted by the Office of the Attorney General in its history. So by taking those doctors who are not following the rules and who are corrupting the system off the street, we're reducing the number of pills that are hitting the street. So you know, those are some of the things that we're focused on. We're also chasing, you know, the big time drug dealers, not just the doctors, but the individuals who traffic heroin on our streets. There's a substance called fentanyl, which you may or may not heard of. This is something that is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin. In its pure form, it's so potent that if you touch it with your skin onto your finger, forget about putting it in your mouth or snorting it or smoking or anything else, you just touch it in its pure form, you may overdose. We've had lab doctors in our state police laboratory by accident touch fentanyl. They were testing it, in order to make a case against the drug dealer. We had to use the antidote, it's called Narcan, to save that person, that lab doctor, from dying. Drug-sniffing dogs have overdosed on this substance called fentanyl. It's that dangerous. So fentanyl is now being laced into heroin to make it more potent. And it's cheaper, it's lighter, it's easier to transport, and it is what is killing more and more people in New Jersey and across the country. So, you know, we're focused on those kinds of drug dealers too.
Wow. Okay, so it seems like you're doing a very good job addressing both the public and the distributors, being the doctors, when it comes to the opioid epidemic, by through education and tightening the rules that you have on these doctors. But what are you doing about the pharmacy companies that distribute these pills across the country?
So the way I look at this is, if I can prevent doctors from putting these pain pills on the street that are causing people to get addicted, I can save a life right now. And so that's where we've acted first, in trying to make sure that, you know, we can take every step that is available to us as soon as we can take it to prevent people from getting addicted before it's too late. As I said before, I do believe the pharma industry had a role. I believe that role to be significant. And we are working, I think has been reported, but not widely, with respect to the pharma companies. And in particular, we have issued subpoenas to manufacturers of opioid painkillers in New Jersey, and that investigation is ongoing. I can't talk to you about the details of what we're doing specifically or where that might lead, but I can say that I believe that the pharma industry, really did have a role, and I think some might say their role was the most significant of any of the players that I mentioned earlier, and I think some would argue that they ought to pay. The truth of the matter, though, is let's assume for a moment that the pharma companies across the country are sued by me and by other attorneys general or the federal government. One day that'll result in the payment of lots of money and maybe some reforms. One day, though, is the point. And I know that those lawsuits are not going to get resolved for months and months and months, if not years. And so we can be deliberate in our work to make sure that if we are going to bring a case against a pharma company, it's a well-reasoned case and a properly investigated case. And we don't have the same time pressure that I feel that we have as it relates to our prevention efforts to see if we can hopefully avoid people from getting addicted in the first place.
Do you think that the money in big pharma, especially in lobbyists, has kind of allowed them to continue making these drugs basically without federal restriction for years? And how do you kind of go about that as a state prosecutor?
Look, it's a fact that billions and billions and billions of dollars have been earned by the pharma companies through the sale of these opioid painkillers. How the feds decided to regulate these drugs is a matter, for the federal government to to consider. And that there has been some action taken on that front in the last couple of months. But, you know, in terms of the licensure, in terms of the approvals that are provided by the FDA, that's not a bell that I can unring. You know, what I can do in New Jersey is try and take steps to make sure that if those pills are going to be dispensed in New Jersey, that they're being dispensed for people who really need them, and that the people who do receive them understand that they are risking becoming a heroin addict by using them.
Interesting. Thank you for that perspective. So when we talk about, you know, you said prevention was really what you're aiming for, but how has the state kind of had reform-based policy for people that are already addicted? So if you look at, like, previous years, drug addicts, like, they just be sent to jail, and oftentimes they'd be able to still get these drugs in jail, whether that be due to, like, drug rings or corrupt prison guards. So how do you think the rehab model of the last few years is going to affect New Jersey and drug addiction in general?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question, Henry, first of all. But what I'll tell you about this is, and Governor Christie's been a real leader in some respects, you know, maybe was one of the only voices in popular politics to be talking loudly about addiction being a disease and trying to remove the stigma from individuals who got addicted. You know, he tells this story, which is a really very good one, and I'll just paraphrase. I mean, really, his point initially was, you know, if a drug addict, instead of being a drug addict, you know, smoked cigarettes and developed lung cancer, you wouldn't blame the individual with lung cancer for smoking. I mean, the hospital will still treat you, insurance will still cover you, and you will hopefully, you know, be saved and rid of cancer. For years and years and years, you show up with addiction, people saying, what do you want me to do? This is your fault. And the truth is, and I think, you know, when we look at how, in response to Max's question, you know, how we got here, people didn't know. People didn't know that they were likely to become addicted by using these painkillers. And so a big part of the challenge here is to remove the stigma. I think that good steps have been taken in New Jersey and now across the country to remove that stigma so that people can get the treatment that they need. Instead of getting surgery for lung cancer, what these folks need is detox and oftentimes long-term treatment. And they have to be prepared to relapse. It happens all the time. And, you know, that is a huge push that is being undertaken right now in the state of New Jersey. Again, not as much by my office, but Governor Christie just announced last week that he's freed up $200 million focused mostly on treatment to try and take these individuals who are already addicted, who are already trapped, you know, in this, with this disease, and to find ways to free them and hopefully get them out of this, you know, endless cycle of addiction.
So, as you may know, the next governor, Phil Murphy, has committed to legalizing marijuana in the state of New Jersey. How do you feel about this, especially with the harm of tobacco and smoking in our state, yeah, in our country?
So good question. I think that, you know, and look, we'll have to see what happens in the gubernatorial race. Phil Murphy is I'm told, based on articles I've read, ahead in the polls, but we don't know where that election is going to go. We'll see in November how that turns out. I think that, you know, there is no question if Phil Murphy is elected governor, that he will support the legalization of marijuana. He said that, and I think he's taken that position pretty clearly. You know, my position on this really has been to defer to the lawmakers and to the policymakers to decide what's in the best interest of the citizens of the state of New Jersey. I think it's popular now. I think most people would be in favor of, if you polled it in New Jersey, the legalization of marijuana. I think that the question that I ask is whether people who believe that marijuana should be legalized really understand all of the all of what that means. And you know, we've taken a hard look at what's happened in Colorado and how the legalization there you know, has affected law enforcement and the community. And you know, lots of interesting facts coming out of Colorado that, you know, I think are important for people to consider as they decide whether they want to lobby their legislators to make marijuana legal, you know, in the state of New Jersey. And, you know, one statistic I think I heard out of Colorado is that there are, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of double the number of recreational marijuana dispensaries in Colorado than there are Starbucks and McDonald's combined. So, you know, it's big business.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. It seems nationally, as regulation on marijuana tends to loosen, it seems like tobacco regulation is actually tightening. And something you and Governor Christie have kind of spearheaded recently is the raising of the smoking age in general. And this applies to both, as people say, like vapes or Juuls, like really big with teenagers, and also like traditional cigarettes. So can you kind of talk about the phenomenon of tightening tobacco regulations as marijuana is kind of loosened?
Yeah, so the steps that have been taken by the governor were his own. And, you know, I think that the legislature and the next governor are and ought to think hard and consider the information that's already available coming out of Colorado and some of the other places where marijuana has been legalized and decide whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. In terms of, you know, the impacts that tobacco has had and how closely aligned marijuana use is to similar impacts is a subject that I haven't studied, but I think it's a point that's important, and I think it's a good one to raise as this conversation continues.
Definitely. I think that leads to a closing of the opioid epidemic. When we come back, we're going to talk about a little bit of the Attorney General's kind of rise to becoming Attorney General and also the storied Bridgegate controversy. You're listening to
104.9 WJRH, The Hour of Influence.
You are listening to WJRH 104.9 FM, Lafayette College Radio, Easton, Pennsylvania. This is the Hour of Influence with Hype Henry and the Kyle.
Hello, so welcome back. We ran a little late this show, so we're going to have to save the Bridgegate and career conversation for two Saturdays. However, we're going to upload the full interview to the WJRH website and Spotify. So, with that being said, we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. We thought it was a very prominent conversation.
It was.
Feel free to write us at the WJRA station to talk about your opinions, and we'll also have a call-in session 2 weeks from now. And also make sure to follow us on Instagram, the Hour of Influence, _WJRH. Thank you very much. We're going to play you guys out with some Ramblin' Man, and we'll see you soon.